This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
So I soon had a suite of boys and girls, mostly boys, and they were following me and talking. We were speaking French and Berber and Arabic, whatever we could make ourselves understood with. And by this time, we talked about the river and whether the kids swam in it. And I said, does anybody swim in it? Oh, yeah, we swim in it. And I said, do you think anybody would mind if I swam in it? No, no, you can swim in it. But don't take off your underpants. I said, oh, no, no, I wouldn't do that. I knew enough by then. This would not be acceptable. So I took off my clothes and left them on the bank and went in. It was a strong current. But I called to the boys and said, I thought you were going to come in. And why aren't you coming in? And they said, we don't have any underpants.
And from our studio deep in the world of illusion that is Sebastopol, California, but which illusion I am very thankful to be into. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller and Hitchhiking Off the Map. Stories about journeys. The trips that got you to wherever you are now.
Wherever. Two stories today. And I guess what they have in common is the experience of ordinary white guys going into an alien world for some other purpose than world conquest and finding something.
One could argue, of course, that the ordinary white guy should just stay home and stay out of other people's faces. But in this time of crisis, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and suggest that it is possible for ordinary white guys to have good intentions.
Thank you.
First story.
We were performing in Hood River, Oregon, at a small theater, and the week before for a Unitarian church in town. We were lodged by members of the congregation, Tom and Marie-Louise Pynchon. Tom was a retired professor, and we asked him what he taught, and he said, Berber. Berber? Berber language. Oh, well, how did that happen?
In eighth grade, they gave me an aptitude test to decide whether I could take foreign languages or not in high school. But I knew full well at that point that I had no aptitude, and so I behaved accordingly and made life miserable for the language teachers. So then I went on to college and majored in art and architecture. But subsequently, after doing a stint in the Navy, I went to Europe, hoping to go actually around the world. And I got to Europe and found that very few people spoke English in those days. And the backpack got rather heavy. And very quickly, this got to be a real drag. So I ended up staying in Germany for a year. And lo and behold, learning a language was a totally different ballgame. It was part of surviving. So I did very well and not only found out that I had an aptitude, pretty reasonably good aptitude, but I had an almost perfect ear for language. So then I decided, well, since I'm really enjoying language, I'll go to France and get my French in shape. So I went to France and went to the Sorbonne, and lo and behold, I stayed for 3 or 4 years and got a degree. But then I met my wife-to-be, Marie-Louise, and decided that courting her wouldn't really be half as much fun from this side of the Atlantic. So I decided I'd stay one more year in France. And at that point, I started a doctorate. And when I went to see my linguistics professor, he told me that I should really try to do some exotic language as a dissertation subject. He had a color-coded map. I forget, there were 4 or 5 different categories. After a little negotiation, he decided that Berber would be a good thing for me to study because Morocco had a very nice climate, and my to-be Danish wife would be able to put up with the climate.
Tom had no connection with Berbers or with Africa, but he started studying, and 3 years later, he was finishing his doctorate in Berber. And UCLA just happened to be creating a position in Berber studies, and he was invited to take the job. So for 28 years, he taught at UCLA. But before that, he went on the first of many trips to Morocco.
Well, the Berbers were the indigenous population of North Africa. It was a very arid climate, for the most part. It's all rock and it's all up and down. So Berbers are typically very poor, hardly any material comforts. Their homes are beaten earth floor, typically made of adobe brick or rammed earth. Let's see, what do I remember clearly about the first trip? The first trip, I met a young man, a Tunisian, and he was going back to his hometown. And his lifestyle was typical of Berber. So he took me along when we went to see his family. And so his father was very old, and obviously everyone's behavior changed totally when he came in. And he came in not unannounced, because no good patriarch ever arrives anywhere unannounced. You have to let people get ready for you and not surprise them in their activities. So you would make sure that you, by coughing, sending a child ahead. And I sat there and was surprised to see that they were building a fire and they were cooking a sheep's head. And the way you cook a sheep's head is you basically set the sheep's head right in the fire, and that burns off all the fur. And then the head cooks there, looking at you as it cooks. And then it's taken out of the fire, and with hands or with a knife, pieces are cut off. And to my astonishment, the prize pieces were the eyeballs. And they were offered to me because I was the most guest-like on the occasion. And I didn't think I could really do that. I didn't think I could eat them. But I felt that refusal would be tantamount to insult. And so I told my friend that I knew that this was the best part of the sheep's head and that I wanted his father to have them. And the father was happy to take them, and probably they knew full well that I was repulsed by the whole thing. But they were polite as well. I subsequently did try one, and it wasn't bad. It wasn't something I looked for again, but I tried just about everything by the end.
Tom talked about his journeys back and forth, and I asked about culture shock, which is often what shapes stories like this. And that wasn't really an issue. But he came back to a trip within a trip. A bike ride one day where nothing much happened except, you might say, a coming into being.
I took a bicycle and crossed over the Atlas Mountains into the Saharan and pre-Saharan areas. And it's a long river valley of extraordinary beauty with villages all dotted along it. It was spring. The water was flowing very clear, cool, so I stopped at this one point along the road, and there was a bridge made out of two logs across the river. But as I went up towards the bridge, I realized that there was a group of women sitting near the bridge in the shade of a tree. And as I approached, it's not polite in North Africa to approach women. So I spoke to them and apologized in Berber for invading their privacy, but I just wanted to wash my feet next to the bridge before I put my socks on. So I sat down on the rock, and they were about 30 feet away from me up on the embankment, and they started carrying on a conversation with me, in particular one older woman, because older women will speak to anybody. And she said, where are you from? So I explained that I was from America. So they asked me things like, did you come on your bicycle from there? And no, I didn't. I came in a boat because it's a long trip. And they said, well, do you have a wife? And I said, yes, I have a wife. I have two children. Where's your wife? And I said, well, she stayed back in America. And they said, well, who takes care of you? You should have a wife. And it was almost banter. They were having fun with me, and I was having fun with them. And she said, well, you could have a wife here. Our women are wonderful. And I said, well, thank you very much, but I think that would be difficult. And she said, you can have her. And she pointed to a young woman over her shoulder who was really very, very attractive. What little I could see of her, her face was very attractive, at least. And I said, oh, no, 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 she's married for sure. Because in these villages, women are married at 13 and 14, usually. And then she got this serious look in her face, and she said, no, she's not married. You can have her. And this was half joking, half serious. And I was beginning to get a little bit uncomfortable with this whole thing. And I said, well, I wouldn't have much to offer because there would be a dowry involved, of course. And I said, I wouldn't have much to offer because all I've got is a bicycle. And she said, well, that'll do. The quality of that day, the beauty of that valley, the beauty of the villages, I came away from that really marked, I think, not only by the extraordinary good humor of everything that had happened there, but my love affair with their lifestyle and the purity of life in an integrated, intact society, even when we can't understand lots of features of that, such as the way women and men relate to each other. It works for them. It works so perfectly for them. I've never seen women appear more radiant and happy than in the very rural areas of North Africa. They just light up. They have this enormous joy within them. I think that living in North Africa has deeply affected me in the things that I want out of my life. I have far less material needs than most people, even though we're sitting in a house that is materialism. I can do without it. I could go on the road and go camping very easily and enjoy life probably just as fully. I've always had an easy time adjusting to whatever was the present reality. So actually coming back was never that difficult. But it's difficult, I think, in the sense that you have an experience that you can't really share with anybody unless they've gone through something very similar in their lives. They can think of them intellectually from what they read in the newspapers and the magazines, but they can't really comprehend what it's like when you look at Afghanistan nowadays. Look at what we've done in the Middle East. A lot of it is just that insensitivity that we have towards the third world. They're not really fully human for many people in this country.
In Hood River, Oregon, we were talking with Tom Pension. This is Hitchhiking Off the Map.
Yeah, people ask us, where do you get these stories? Where do you find people? Well, there's a very large world population, I guess. We don't have a research staff. We don't have press agents calling us about Al Gore's book tour. People email us. We invite you to email us if you've got a story through our website, www.independenteye.org. Or we just meet people and ask questions. You know, how did you get here? How did you come about doing that? The only thing that's absolutely boring about ordinary people is when they try hard to convince you they're ordinary.
What I love are the details. What did the guard actually say at the border crossing? What toys did you leave behind? Now, this next piece is a fictional story, but like most of our work, it comes from real experience. If you've been to Honolulu, you can look east over Waikiki to the rim of an extinct volcano. This is Diamond Head.
This story, when I came back from Hawaii, I told this to... I didn't really talk to my wife much about it, but I was telling a colleague, and suddenly I was making sounds like kids do when they're playing fantasy games, you know, like space monsters, or war. And yeah, I was saying, telling about the trip, well, we're flying, and so on, and it was embarrassing. I just sort of trailed off because I climbed up Diamond Head and nothing actually happened, and I'm not sure this is what didn't actually happen. It's my first time in Hawaii. We're bidding on a job. One of the big hotels in Waikiki upgraded their data systems and their files seem to have contracted herpes, and so we're bidding on a very thankless job. So I drive in from the airport. Late morning, rental car, because I really want to see some of the island tomorrow before I fly back. So I bought a guidebook, and my appointment's at 3, and I've still got some time to kill. That mountain there. Diamond Head. That's a volcano, yeah. That's on my list. It's extinct, but then you should never say extinct in relation to a volcano. That might be pushing your luck. Inactive, retired, on sabbatical. No surprises. Could I drive up there? Just see what... I dreamed this. Last night, motel in L.A. reading the guidebook, and then... Pele. Which is funny, because I've never been interested in mythology, religion, that stuff, although I realize these concepts speak to a deep longing and blah, blah, blah. Most of my dreams focus on data systems. But volcanoes? Yeah. So, drive up. Yeah, up around into a tunnel, out, and... Diamond Head. God, I dreamed this. I'm in the crater. What used to be the crater, kind of like it's filled up with Oklahoma. Flat, kind of, arid, dry vegetation, military buildings, fences, keep out, danger, death. Rock walls around like a huge stadium. What am I doing here? Okay, it's on my list, and if I see it today, then I don't have to see it tomorrow. So I see it. Good. Great. No big deal. Oh, there's a trail up to the rim. Sign says, oh, damn, takes an hour and a half up and back. Oh, yeah, Pele, she's the goddess of a volcano or something. Yeah, I suppose if you got a volcano, you better have somebody in charge, so Pele. But that's funny. A friend of mine said they don't talk about Pele. They haven't even seen her on T-shirts. They must be scared. So, let's see. Here we had five temples, so the god of the winds, who was Pele's nephew, wouldn't blow out the fires. A line of signal fires along the top of the rim they burned to signal the boats that went out to come back. God, the way the wind shapes the trees. I could climb up, stand on the peak of the rim, talk to the wind. Hello there. I can't get to the top, no way, I don't have time, but let's say 30 minutes, so I could hike up there till quarter after, get a better view maybe, take some pictures, and then turn around. That'll still give me time to drive down for the appointment, having communed with nature. No, I've got time. Start up the trail. Nice wide trail, slow and steady. Wonder what the latitude is, it's incredibly arid. So we're supposed to feel the gods were here. I guess if you believe in data systems, then you might as well believe in the gods. Maybe I'm here for a reason. Maybe I'm nuts. Maybe. Here we go. Getting rocky. Zigzag.
Zigzag.
Zigzag. Tricky. This is tricky. What's the time? Plenty of time. What was the dream? Dream, yeah. Woke me up. Steps. Something about steps. 100. I had to make the decision if I wanted to live 100 years. Entirely my decision. Be 100 years old. Very serious decision. Where that came from.
Zigzag.
I could stop here, just stop at the zigger, right at the zag. Spend time looking at gray, black, ugly rock.
Zigzag.
And she's not saying nothing. Not zigzag. Today, not to me, not Pele.
Zigzag.
Okay, let's see. They used the temples till 1819. And in 1819, they abolished the religion. How do you abolish a religion? Just tell the gods they're no longer required? We're downsizing. We're outsourcing the divinity. We need gods with better brand recognition. Gods you can franchise. Gods that are multinational. Gods that take human sacrifice by the millions and not by the twos and threes. No temples, no fires, no more. One of the boatmen find their way. Steps.
Zigzag. Zigzag.
Zigzag. Steps. Zigzag. Numbered. Up and up. Zigzag. Just get up. I have to start back. Zigzag. Train two. Train three. My God. 40 minutes, I have an appointment for a major contract. And what am I doing here? 40. 42. 44. This is nuts. I'll die. My wife will be horror-struck and then very pissed. 62. 63. I could pitch straight back for it from here and croak ergonomically instead of this pointless, idiotic climbing up steps and steps. And 97. 98. 99. Yes, damn it. I'm looking for something. Voices, birds, fires, gods, thunder, erupting, ecstatic, real, and I'm here. I'm alive. I'm at the top. Oh, wow. Take it. I'm out of film. I want to feel something now. Hear voices. Gods who have suffered no abolition. 5 temples, and then they abolished that, and at some point in time the army took it over and they put in gun emplacements. I could have saved all the trouble. I could have just stood still in the center of this dead, extinct, impotent, cold-ass volcano and yelled for the gods to come out of hiding. Come out of there! Nothing but wind. No film. I am a dead, extinct, impotent, cold-ass tourist. Okay. On my appointment. I have to go. Go, go, go. Go. But I did it. I made it in 20 minutes, I did. Poor guys drudging up here, they see the steps, they're ready to die in place. 20 minutes up, maybe 15 down, I won't have to do this again. Tomorrow, I'll check it off the list and... Oh, God, what did I do? I did it again. Climb way the hell up Diamond Head to set a record? I don't live my damn life, I send a representative.
Go.
There's a woman, maybe 30, blonde, down the trail, carries her baby in a front harness thing, and the baby's cute, and so is the lady, and I loop up alongside, say, she doesn't look the least bit tired. Baby looks me in the eye. So much wonder in those eyes. She starts to cry. The mother snuggles her, and she cries, and then they go off. She cries. Not fear, no pain. She cries because she'd gone all the way to the top and she'd seen the gods.
And she hears the gods of the wind, the gods of the sea, the rain, the trees and the blood and the fire under all, the fire rising up alive. The birds and flowers burst on the withered trees, red, yellow, and purple gods, and orange, and blue.
And then, I'm at my appointment. Five minutes late, but I made it. I have not the foggiest notion. I took care of my business, had supper. I walked on the beach by great hotels where the tourists erupt and excrete and dream.
Okay, that's good.
That night I dreamt.
Good. Thank you.
I was 100 years old. I had agreed to be 100 years old, agreed to risk life, agreed to live. Oh, God. 100 years. I was climbing steps, climbing to the rim of the crater, the sharp lips of Pele, slowly. Earth shaking under me, low growlings like birth. Birds fly up by the millions, clouds orange and green and white, and the mother is screaming and laughing, growling and crying and laughing, and I'm going up step by step, 62, 63, 64, to the top, and get there before I wake, 89,
90, filled with lava, fluid. 97, 98, 99.
It's a fantasy. It's a story. It's a total lie. It's childish. You know, oh, please, come with me.
You're listening to Diamond Head, written and performed by me and Elizabeth. That's Elizabeth's music also, as is just about everything you hear on the show. And I did actually, a couple of years ago, climb up the rim of Diamond Head very rapidly, and I had no spiritual awakening, whatever. But a friend once said, the journey is the story you tell about it, so maybe it's true.
That's our trips for this week. Hitchhiking Off the Map is produced by The Independent Eye with funding from the National Endowment for the Arts and the California Arts Council.
And from the Hitchhikers Guild. Visit our website, www.independenteye.org. Send us your comments and your email address. We send out monthly updates. Also look at our CDs and listen to past shows online.
Next up, people talk to us about the concept of home, and a news reporter plots to hug the president.
But not this president. This is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller, in hopes that in this next century, after five pretty bloody ones, the ordinary white guys who go on those long journeys come back with snapshots of people in peace and joy.
Peace and joy.
I've never been so productive as in really primitive conditions in a rural village where I had no table to write on or any bathroom to go to or any kitchen to cook with. Finding yourself at a very local level like that, where the limits of the universe really are the hillsides that surround you, is an energizing experience. It makes you much more in touch with the now than in our frantic life, especially urban life.